to this segment of A Day at DPL, a thought leadership series that is part of the Advisor Revelations podcast. You will hear from DPL's founder and CEO, David Lau, and a special guest where they will discuss educational topics around industry trends and best practices, providing advisor insights to grow your business and better serve clients.
Good morning and welcome to the podcast, John Thiel. We've got a very distinguished guest this morning, John, who spent 27 years at Merrill Lynch, where he was ultimately the head of wealth management and had a number of tremendous accomplishments throughout his career there, and has now decided to launch an RIA firm. And so welcome, John.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Terrific. So you've launched, Indivisible Partners after spending a long time in the brokerage industry. Talk a little bit about your time at Merrill Lynch first. What are, some of the proudest things you built? You were a very well-known guy in the financial services industry and really drove Merrill to some new heights during your tenure there. But, for you personally, what was some of the most rewarding accomplishments you had during that time?
Well, like many leaders in the history, I was a financial advisor first. So I came to Merrill Lynch in 1999 after having spent 3 years in the insurance business, mostly writing corporate health insurance and then carving out the executives to talk to them about some of the other risk management with life insurance, disability, and the like. And I just came to Merrill Lynch and really felt at home with the breadth of what we could offer clients. And at the time, our leader was trying to stress financial planning and wasn't getting a lot of sort of interest from the advisors. This, again, was a long time ago. But to me, it was very natural to do financial planning with the experience I had in the insurance industry, as well as I was a CPA. I was in public accounting for 3 years before that and spent a couple tax seasons really helping people with that. So when you put it all together, I was really able to have meaningful conversations with clients and didn't have, let's just call it, an overabundance of investment management training, so that I didn't let it and the acronyms and the complexity creep into conversations. And I think a lot of people found that refreshing. The firm thought that I had more to give as it relates to leadership than my personal productivity, which, maybe they were right. As it turns out, I think they were. So I went into leadership really because I thought I could make a bigger difference. And I did that in 1995 and, spent several great years. And all of those experiences were wonderful experiences. I lived in Chicago, San Francisco, and New York. So I got a lot of different perspectives. And the thing that I think I felt great about was not only helping advisor teams, helping them build teams, help them think about workflow and efficiency, but it was also an opportunity to get to know clients of other advisors on a deeper basis and be, let's just say, sort of that objective person, obviously supporting the advisor, but be able to really have conversations with them that maybe perhaps the advisor couldn't have that kind of conversation with. And it ultimately helped both the advisor and the client. So those were some of the highlights, other than living in some really interesting places.
That's cool. So what kind of things did you think you could talk to clients about that like you wouldn't as an advisor?
Well, estate planning. You need to think about it, right? I was a CPA. I kept my license until 1995. And in the insurance business, I learned an enormous amount about different planning techniques. And so to be able to have those conversations comfortably, because we weren't, think back then, really training advisors in wirehouses for sure about insurance solutions other than perhaps fixed annuities. And so it was a real opportunity to take a little pressure off the advisor and think more holistically about what the purpose of their wealth was.
Yeah, it's been interesting. I mean, you and I have both been around financial services long enough to kind of see this evolution of the advice model in very high level generic ways. I mean, the financial advisor almost, it grew up as a broker, right? Basically a salesperson, individual stocks, mutual funds, who's the hot manager? Can I get you into Peter Lynch's Magellan Fund? What can we do to, basically sell you product? And the idea was just simply about wealth accumulation.
Right.
And how much money can we build for you in your wealth? And it's really been kind of a slow evolution to actually, that's not what it's all about. You know, there is this planning notion. There are insurance and risk management issues. There's estate planning. There's all kinds of things, I think, probably driven up from the client, you know, looking for more services from their advisor. And kind of, you know, what was your experience kind of firsthand in Merrill as that world evolved?
That absolutely was the case. Clients were looking for more. I think advisors were looking to do more for their clients. And I really think in one instance, the certified financial planning designation really caught hold as we emphasized financial planning. And we tried to encourage our advisors to pursue that designation. At one time, we had over 3,000. I'm sure there's more now above the advisors as CFPs, and really make it more like a profession. Mm-hmm. Because of the continuing education, the barrier, you know, the test and code of ethics, right? All important elements to a client who's trying to come up with an objective analysis of one's skill set and talent. That was I think it was very helpful. And obviously the advisors were very capable once they passed that exam of understanding some of the more nuanced elements of, you know, wealth accumulation and wealth decumulation.
Yeah, I spend time now. I volunteer with the CFP board on their Standards Resource Commission. And I've always thought very highly of the CFP board and creating that professional designation. But working with them, I have even more of an appreciation. Boy, it is extremely thorough how, you know, we vet through issues for financial advisors before putting guidance out there, how you should handle different situations or clients or assets or technology, whatever it might be. It's been a great eye-opening experience for me in a very positive way. And, you know, I help develop the standards on insurance and how CFPs, you know, look at review insurance.
Well, and I give the industry a lot of credit that we committed to and made available. The advisors always wanted to do more. They wanted to be as relevant as can be, but you've got to make it easy for them, easier for them to do that. And I think people responded effectively. And that's all, to me, for better outcomes for clients, because that and the other designations that have come as a part of that, whether it be CMER, CPWA, of course, CFA, I just think it all says to the client that I've taken extra care to prepare to be as, you know, as helpful as I can be to you.
Absolutely. So as you've now gone into the independent space, you know, launching, you know, Indivisible Partners, what's your vision for Indivisible? And so it's kind of nice when you've got a blank slate.
Yeah.
And you can just say, I can build whatever I want. And so what's kind of your vision for Indivisible?
Well, first and foremost, we want to make sure that the advisor and the advisor client relationship is put out front and invested in and made the priority. I just feel like perhaps that slipped away a bit over the last many years, and we've certainly had our fair share of existential events that have put a lot of pressure on all aspects of life, but certainly that relationship between the advisor and the client and the firm. And so we really want to celebrate the advisor and that relationship with the client, which we think is the most enduring in, for sure, financial services, but maybe in business, and invest in it versus other components. Helping the advisor have as efficient a platform as possible so that the workflow is automated to the greatest extent so that it's easy to process the workflow that's necessary with that, but also create real customization for that experience for them and for the client, because each advisor has a preference as to what they view when they come in the morning. Each client associate and service person on your team is going to have a different point of view on that. And then as a client, which I have been for, you know, the last 15 years and the last 7 years, a retired client, the ability to see my information the way I prefer versus the way the firm would curate it. And so that customization capability is really important. We want the advisors to own 100% of their business, and we would want to be their partner and create this partnership where not only do we work together to curate this platform to keep ensuring that it's the best that it can be, but it's just, you know, it's important for us to have that relationship with the advisor that they know that we're in it together. And so the advisor, while they own 100% of their practice, they also own a piece of everybody else that's on the Indivisible Partners platform because we grant them profit interests when they join the organization. So everybody theoretically and is cheering for one another to do well because everybody owns a little piece of everyone else.
That's tremendous. And I know we got connected through David Cantor, who is, you know, Fidelity. And I've been just incredibly impressed with your team. And not only their current capabilities, but what everybody's done in the past. I mean, you've kind of assembled a bit of an all-star team there at the executive level, you know, as you're setting up this platform for advisors.
Yeah, we were fortunate that life sort of met at the intersection of all of our experiences back in a similar situation. So John Hogarty and I, who was the COO for the wealth management business at Bank of America and Merrill Lynch, and I have been retired for 7 years, but constantly thinking about what was yet to be done, just really understanding that, you know, a job is never really complete as much as the world evolves. And we felt like there was more we could do to help advisors help clients. And we also had that view of being a client ourselves, as well as all the experience we had. So we got together, and then some other folks had retired that we worked with and thought very highly of. And our philosophy kind of was, we want to work with people we know, like, and trust first and foremost, if we're going to do something else. And we wanted to work with a team that we knew we could operate together. And we just found that several of our former colleagues were in similar situations at this stage of their life where they had a lot of gas left in the tank. They kind of wanted to do something, wanted to do it the right way versus the way someone else might think is the right way. We feel very strongly that we know how to do this well and proven it, as you suggest, with our experience at Merrill Lynch and Fidelity. And so it's an opportunity for us to sort of recast and do it in a way in which we think we can make a big difference for the advisor and their clients.
That's terrific. So one of the things that I think of immediately with a team like that is the plans and the goals have got to be big. Right. You're not looking to do something small here. You're looking to do something big. So, you know, tell me a little bit about the goals. What are you envisioning for Indivisible Partners over the next 3-5 years?
Well, first and foremost, whether it's big or small, we want to be great. Mm-hmm. And we want to demonstrate to the industry what's possible for advisors and clients and how they interact. So that includes obviously curating a tech stack that is as functional and efficient as it possibly can be for the advisor, that allows for this customization, that allows, and this doesn't get talked about enough, in my opinion, the ability for the client to collaborate with their advisor more completely. Because there are a lot of us who are clients who want to spend more time on our own scenario planning without, quote unquote, wasting the advisor's time. We understand they're busy, but that's hard to do at most places. And we want to make sure that that's included. And then as far as the size, you know, we just want to attract quality advisors credentialed with a clear investment process and a service standard that meets client preferences and that is open to a fiduciary-only relationship where we're transparent around fees, around risks, and most importantly, around outcomes. And so we think a relatively conservative financial plan, but one that will reward the advisors and the clients and then the shareholders of our firm.
That's terrific. I love the client-centric focus. I mean, I think of myself as a consumer advocate, very client-centric. I've spent my career trying to reduce costs from, you know, effectively product manufacturers to give clients better, you know, better ultimate products. And I love thinking about the client first. And as my background, I'm a marketer, right? And marketers are always like thinking about what the clients need and how do you message the clients, what their needs are. And in financial services, I've found it like not to the same extent. It's not everybody is focused that way. A lot of advisors, firms are like, here's what I do and here's why it should work for you and here's why it's okay. And here's, let me explain to you why what I do is good and why it's smart and why it works. Rather than talking to the client, there's maybe they do a risk management, you know, questionnaire when they take them on, and then they say, okay, you fit into this lane or that lane or the other lane. You know, so tell me a bit about client-centric and all that it means to you and Indivisible.
Well, it's, you know, candidly why we chose to work with you, David, is that we sense that we see actually your ability to demonstrate sort of best interest with the types of solutions that you offer and the way in which you price them and the way that the clients benefit and the advisors benefit from that. And it's clear, it's transparent, which is to me sort of another way that we build trust with clients. And so we're very curious as to what advisors and clients think, and we will set up formal routines to capture the advisors' points of view, the advisors' opportunity for us to improve, but also what we'll do the same for, with clients, to talk to those clients, to understand what it is that we could do to be more relevant to them in concert and partnership with their advisor. So we'll set up formal mechanisms to gather that feedback. To me, it's one of the most fun things to do is to really build relationships and learn, because there's really many clients that we serve are not surveillable, if you will. If you're a marketer, you know that. They're not going to show up for a Diet Coke and $500. Right. So we've got to do something more unique and differentiating to get their feedback. And what I've found over really 15 years, that they really welcome it, especially when you make changes based on their recommendations, which I had done and will absolutely be willing to do as we continue to build this platform.
Yeah, that's great. Recognition that you heard them by making whatever change you guys had talked about. Yeah, that's a great way of solidifying relationship. And I've been working with advisors for, you know, 20, 25 years myself. And one of the things that always struck me as a disconnect here too was advisors talk about, particularly when the market's going a little haywire and there's, you know, volatility like we've had, you know, much of this year, they say, I'm playing psychologist more than, you know, financial advisor. I'm trying to talk my clients off the ledge, stay the course, you know, don't do anything rash here. You know, everything's going to be fine. It's like psychological. But on the other hand, it's like, maybe to me, there's a gap between maybe the service or the investments you've provided and their psychology, you know, where maybe you didn't hear them. Maybe they're not okay with the market volatility. Intellectually, you should be, but emotionally as a client, when it's your money, and particularly when you're near retirement or in retirement, not so easy to stay the course. And so I always thought that was a bit of a disconnect, you know, for advisors who think it's on the client to adapt to what I'm doing rather than think about maybe I can alter my strategy. And I think since you came out of insurance, at least for the early part of your career, you know, risk management is something I don't think advisors pay attention to enough. But you hear all of these things, right? And for me, it's always perplexing, like, well, why don't you pay more attention to risk management? Because you hear about the psychology and having to deal with clients who are iffy and worried during volatility. And then you hear about how most clients hate losing money more than they like making money. And yet, most advisors are focused on accumulation and building wealth and not risk management.
Right. Well, you're describing well behavioral finance, right? And how we think it's really important to have those conversations. And it requires a mindset shift for many advisors to have that, let's call it a pretty vulnerable conversation with clients, and really may help them get comfortable enough to share what those concerns are. It's why one of the questions that we love to make sure that clients get a chance to answer is, what's the purpose of your wealth? And really understand, what is it you're trying to accomplish with it? Not necessarily assume they just want to grow it at all costs. And it has a job to do, and risk is the threat, right? That you can't complete the work. I always felt it was really important. And clients, I think, generally can understand what the concept of risk is. And do you pass that risk to someone else, or do you own that risk? And I think they're capable of understanding the difference between those two. And, you know, someone who has, you know, been retired for 7 years or was, it was wonderful. We know we retire on our balance sheet, but turning that into cash flow, mm-hmm. not quite as easy as it seems. Mm-hmm. And it becomes that what you worry about versus how big the pile is, because ultimately you live on cash flow. And so those are risks that need to be addressed. And you need to have that conversation out in the open about what, you know, what it is that I need to support my lifestyle and how do I do that? And the most efficient being from a risk management perspective way possible.
Yeah. And it's been, I think there's been an evolution that I've seen, which I don't think is a good one, in from, I don't know, 07, when interest rates really started to decline, and at the same time, you're getting life expectancy going longer. What's happened in, like, when I came up early in financial services, you know, you used to know this glide path, right? You're invested 70, 30, maybe 60, 40 early while you're accumulating, and then you're moving to 30, 70 stocks to bonds, you know, as you get into retirement, you have to de-risk. And that doesn't happen as much anymore. It really, you know, 60-40 is now considered a conservative portfolio, not the inverse. And it's because interest rates went down and you weren't yielding anything from fixed income. And also then you have this life expectancy. So you can't, you need to, you know, fund more cash flow in some fashion. And so I think those are both bad things for the typical retiree who's worried about risk and income in retirement. And that's why I always read with amusement, you know, people who talk about funding retirement and income, and they never mention an annuity. And an annuity is a tremendous way of helping fund retirement and de-risking and handling some, you know, some things like that. But I've seen that as, you know, as a problem ultimately for retirees as they're taking on more risk than they're comfortable with.
Yeah, no, I think it's really important that they understand that source of income and how reliable that source of income is, and incorporate into that things like Social Security and their future earnings potential. But that, and tools are available now to help quantify that for clients and demonstrate why, you know, in your case, in this case, using an annuity might be the best outcome for that portion of the portfolio. Because sometimes you just need to run the numbers to show people and give them comfort that can work. And then obviously your counterparty, which is important, it will guarantee it. And the states will ensure that that happens.
So, you know, insurance products do play a role. And I think, you know, that's part of what we're trying to, you know, drive at DPL, because I saw this issue where you have fiduciary advisors in the RIA space, you know, where, and they're fiduciaries obviously in other channels, but the who couldn't use, you know, insurance products, including, you know, annuities and life, in their business model, you know, in their compensation model. And it had been happening all across asset management already. People moving away from transactional commissioned revenue, you know, to fee-based revenue, getting paid for advice, not sales. And it wasn't available, you know, on a widespread basis, you know, in insurance. And we're trying to knock down that barrier so that advisors wouldn't have that financial conflict of recommending risk management products and it affecting their income, you know, which you've got to be a real fiduciary to do. So we help, you know, try to knock down those barriers and continue to educate and drive adoption of the products, which is a very interesting proposition. You see advisors who are like, hey, finally, this is fantastic. And others who are, you know, still very much investments only. It's what we do. And it's great to work with advisors who, you know, who see the full picture.
Well, in my, you know, personally, my parents lived till 92 and almost 91. And I saw that the pressure that created for them. Fortunately, I did well enough to step in and to help when necessary. It actually motivated me. The idea of living long motivated me to, you know, in my case, really think about long-term care, the cost of that long-term care, which I was seeing as we looked for a place for my father who had dementia, and thought, well, why would I take that particular risk if I could offload that risk and for a modest amount of money create, you know, in my case, 6 years of really meaningful income from that insurance solution to pay for that. That's one that doesn't make sense for me to self-fund because of the unknown. And then to see what the alternative is from a care perspective, if you can't afford it, it's really pretty sad.
Yep.
The difference in level of care, the cleanliness of the facility and all those. So
absolutely,
all those life issues come into play when you're making a decision like that.
No doubt. And one of the positive things in many ways I've seen happening, you know, in the RIA space is really the advent of bigger firms. And it's not that there's anything wrong with small firms. You know, smaller boutique firms will always have a place and their clients will always want that. But in many ways, what I've seen is 20 years ago, a $1 billion firm was a big firm in the RIA channel. Now, today, I don't know what you'd consider a big firm, $25 billion maybe, you know, might be considered a big firm. But what's happened is the expansion of services for clients. So, you know, when you have a small firm that has five employees, you know, it's hard to have all the diverse expertise you need to serve all the different client needs. And it's not that they can't deliver the services, though they can outsource and, you know, and find partners. And we partner with many of those firms in great ways. But I think having, you know, building a firm and having a, you know, broader set of expertise has really been a big trend we've seen in the RIA channel.
Well, it's the way I look at it, to unpack all that. The easiest way for me to think about it is our clients bring complexities, and they're varied and different depending on the client. And you need to have either on that particular team or available in the organization the capability to face off against that complexity. And that's really critical, I think, in delivering the best chance to deliver the, you know, on the outcomes that that client wants. And it's necessary. So whether that be tax, estate planning, or more blending, more sophisticated, you know, investment solutions, whatever that might be, the clients have the complexities. We owe it to them to make sure that we have the capabilities to really to help them address those complexities.
Absolutely. And so what do you see happening in the RIA channel? We're in the RIA channel, you know, a lot of people say the world's cyclical, right? The same thing happens, maybe just a little bit of a different iteration. I think if you look at the wirehouse channel, you'll probably know better than me, but the name of Merrill Lynch isn't Merrill Lynch. It's Merrill Lynch and like six other last names, right? It wound up being something that was a result of a lot of consolidation and acquisition. Do you see the same thing, you know, happening in the RIA space? I mean, obviously it's starting to go on, but do you see it getting to that type of scale?
I do. It's funny. In 2005, we had Moss Adams come speak to us about considering a alternate channel, which others had done, obviously being potential, you know, sort of quasi-independent. And I just recall turning to a colleague of mine and saying, you know, what's going to happen is they're going to go out and do this, and they're going to get big, and they're going to end up looking just like what it is that they ran from.
That's right.
So it's come true.
That's right.
Right. And there's an enormous amount of capital ensuring that it's almost inevitable.
Yep.
Because of the aggregators and, you know, and private equity's interest in our business. And that actually, when I talked to a lot of RIAs as we were putting this idea together, realizing how distracting it actually is, how many calls they get per week for them to sell or to monetize or to merge into other people. And it's happening, and it's going to happen. And we operated at scale. We know what it takes to operate at scale. And what we plan on doing is bringing all the benefits of scale without the lowest common denominator approach to running and supervising an organization, because that's ultimately what I think the risk is that you just have so much variability in the way people deliver that you end up having to limit the offering. And that is not at all what we plan to do. We are going to create that opportunity to curate and be relevant to clients and not get to that point where we have to close down ideas.
Yeah, I think that like the experience that your team and you bring is really valuable, because we get a pretty unique seat in working with many different firms, and lots of the acquirers and aggregators, and many of them are outstanding, but they might be acquiring 20, 25 businesses a year, which is a different job than managing an RIA, right? And that's a very specific expertise, and doing that well is really, really difficult, so that the client doesn't suffer, your operations don't suffer. That's a big challenge. But like you said, that's where the industry is driving right now. It's like a race.
And to complicate it, one of the reasons we did this, we saw a couple sort of lingering issues that we wanted to help address, which one was organic growth is a challenge. We think we're pretty good at helping teams grow. We have a long history of doing that, and the ways in which and the markets in which they can grow. But the other one really is this sort of lack of coherent succession plans for the reality of our advisor force, which is an aging advisor force. I mean, you know, McKinsey, they just put out that a third of the advisors will retire in the next 10 years. It's over 100,000 advisors. that's a substantial portion of the people that are out there working with clients. And so we are built to help them with that conversation and help them build and develop that next generation so that they ultimately realize the value of their life's work within their practice. But those are all challenges. And so not only are you transitioning these businesses into your business, but you better stop and make sure that they're prepared for the next event, which is them passing that business on to somebody else. And I think that the firm has a responsibility to help advisors do that well.
Absolutely. So I'll test your, we won't know this answer for a while, but I'll test your prognosis capabilities. You know, a lot of people talk about there being a trillion-dollar RIA, like wirehouses are, you know, many trillions of dollars. I think Merrill's probably $6-7 trillion in assets under management, something like that, probably. Do you see a trillion-dollar RIA, and how far off do you think it is?
Well, no, I do. I think it's just the compounding is going to make that happen, right? It's because they're getting bigger, and you know, the markets typically provide rates of return. So could they grow at 10%? Yeah. And so that's going to double in 7 years. And so, yeah, I do think that's going to happen, and I'm okay with it. I think it's great. That's not really our goal to build that quickly. It's to do something more for us that feels right and the right size. But yes, I think that's going to happen. And I think that's okay because the infrastructure, the technology, the custodians, it's all there to provide for that. I think Fidelity has almost $15 trillion. So yeah, It can absolutely happen.
Yeah, I think so too. And I think it's going to be at least 3 years, but maybe within the next 5 years. And I think it's going to be probably more than one. The big guys are going to start acquiring the big guys, and you're going to get some, you know, scale through that as well.
Yeah. And they need to be set up to be relevant to the next generation of clients, not just advisors. Mm-hmm. Because there will be, eventually this wealth transfer will take place. I don't know when.
That's right.
I'm not looking to transfer mine anytime soon. Right. But that reality is going to happen. And that's going to, whoever can capture their fair share will make that happen sooner.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see how it evolves. But there's certainly, to me, having been, you know, working in the RIA channel for about 20 years, the evolution of the channel is amazing. It used to be, you know, you had one technology that you got from your custodian. It was probably pretty limited. God knows how many technology options you now have as an RIA firm. The ability to have people help you launch and find different models within what you might be looking for. The support for the channel is just night and day, you know, from what it was 20 years ago.
It was one of the most exciting and pleasant observations is to see how far innovation has come within the technology capabilities. We ourselves, you know, you're part of that. We've curated, we have our platform provider Advise-On. We've integrated your opportunity set within us so that it's single sign-on, that it's interoperable. So when there's data change, I mean, to think about how efficient that can be is for advisors and their clients is, it's really remarkable how much it's come along. And we think it's, you know, you hate to sit there and do a tit for tat, but we think our technology stack is very unique in that sense, is that it's got end-to-end capabilities across any sort of significant need that a client has, and it's all integrated and it's interoperable, and it all comes back to a single client record. So reporting is easy, and viewing and customization, all the things we talked about earlier, are all there for the client so that they can consume it the way they want.
Yeah, that's fantastic. That's another example of the cyclical nature of the RIA. Used to have one consolidated system, then all these point solutions came about. And then because I need a better planning system or a rebalancing system or whatever it is, and then you have all these systems that don't talk to each other, and it gets incredibly inefficient. And then people say, well, now we need more integration. We need things to work better together. And I think that's been a huge drive.
And guess what that costs, right? That costs a lot of money.
That's right. It not only costs money, nobody likes to do it.
Right.
Particularly if you're a financial advisor.
It's why the innovation with APIs is so important. You know, you can unplug and plug back in something that's more effective for you at any time. There's certainly integration work, but it's not nearly what it would take if you had a legacy platform and how much you'd have to spend, because I know, because we had to.
Right. Terrific. Well, it's been great having you on the podcast, John. And I don't know if you have any parting words you want to deliver. And again, we're super excited about the partnership with Indivisible and very excited to see how you build and grow the firm.
Well, we just appreciate so much your partnership and how you've innovated. And you've really, I think, taken some of the things that held back people using risk management and using those products and services more effectively. You've taken a lot of the friction out of that and allow us really to be that fiduciary. So I just applaud what you've done and I thank you for your partnership and I look forward to a lot more with you.
Terrific. I appreciate those kind words and I look forward to getting out on the golf course with you at some point.
That sounds wonderful. Thank you, David.
All right, John. Thank you so much.
Take care.
Thanks for listening. To hear more advisor revelations, go to dplfp.com and subscribe on your favorite podcast streaming app.